This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Erev Tov, Chodesh Tov. First of all, I'd like to thank again the Pardes people and the Bretter family for inviting me. And I'd like to be more exact. We are going to speak about stories and not about Agadah as well. And let me define at the very beginning what I'd like to do in this meeting and the next few meetings. As you may know, I'm Israeli. I was born in Prague, but I came to Israel or was brought to Israel when I was 3 years old. So my English is in Israeli English. Usually I apologize for that at the very beginning, because I know that my crowd is usually divided into two groups. Those who came to learn Sipurim and those who came to make fun of my English. And I can promise both groups that they will enjoy this evening for sure. What can I tell you? As a Israeli professor, I know that my English is not as good as suspected. My professor is not as bad as some of my colleagues or students may say in front of me on my back, but we do it the best we can. So, good evening again, and Erev Tov, Chodesh Tov. We are going to speak about stories which are found in the rabbinic literature, the rabbis, or as they are called, usually Chachameinu Zichram Livracha. And here as a teacher, I have to say something about the Zichram Livracha. Because everywhere, when I found the term Chazal, Chachameinu, Zichram Livracha translated into English, it usually is our sages of blessed memory. And this is a big mistake, which I'd like to correct at the very beginning. Chachameinu Zichram Livracha has nothing to do with memory. The Hebrew word Zecher does not mean memory. Zecher means name. That's in the biblical meaning of Zecher, in the rabbinic, or even the Siddur, and each of us can easily be reminded of texts like Nishmat Kol Chai, Tevarechet Shimcha, Ruach Kol Basar Tefa'er, Zichacha. Shem and Zecher are parallel. Ze Shmi Le'olam, says the book, Veze Zichri Le'dor Dor. And even the mitzvah about the Amalek, Zachor Et Asher Asa Lecha Amalek. We are to remember what Amalek did to us. And then what is the mitzvah? Once you'll be able to do whatever you can do, machot timche et zecher Amalek, which means what? Wipe out not the memory of Amalek. Lo al tishkach. How can you order me, don't forget to forget? It's not machot timche, erase the memory of Amalek. Remember Amalek, but the name. That no person upon earth will be Amalekite. So the name Amalekite will disappear from upon earth. But the memory of the Amalekite should be remembered forever and ever. So Zecher means, so I would translate Chazal, our sages, whose name is mentioned as a blessing. Not of blessed memory, but that's a small fact. But as a teacher, I could not do it. So the rabbis, as we call them, Chachameinu Zichram Livracha, which were thousands of people probably, we know about 2,400 names of those rabbis. Many people find the number 2,400 is a surprising huge number. And I say it's a very small number. Because if you read the rabbinic text, which we mentioned soon, the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, and the Midrashim, and the Siddur, or the Haggadah of Pesach, and you find 2,400 names, it sounds a huge number of names, but no. If we remember that the sages lived over a period of 600 years, more or less, I start to count by Hillel and Shammai, who passed away around the beginning of the common era, right? Around the common era, Hillel and Shammai, Jerusalem, no, it's two streets in Jerusalem, Hillel and Shammai. Never meet. The idea of junction, Hillel and Shammai, sounds impossible. Anyhow, Hillel and Shammai began at the beginning of the common era, and the rabbis, more or less, the period of the rabbis is ended around some years before the conquest of Islam, when the Muslims came here around 630. So we speak about 600 years of creativity in the land of Israel, in Babylonia, in North Africa, in South Europe, like Italy and Cyprus, and of course the huge Babylonia all the way to Iraq, Persia, whatever, 2,400 names to 600 years, it's four names a year that were added to the huge amount of rabbis. Probably the number was 10 times bigger, if not more than that, but 2,400 names are recorded in our sources. Some of them are very famous. Everybody knows Rabbi Akiva because of Bnei Akiva. And everybody knows Rabbi Meir because of Cafe Meir, but Cafe Hillel, but basically, we speak about a huge number of people who lived a span of 600 years in various historical, geographical, and cultural settings. You cannot compare the first century when the land of Israel was under Roman rule to the fifth century when Byzantine took over, or in Babylonia, the Persian, whatever. I mean, that huge number of people who never spoke about themselves as Chazal. Chachameinu zichram livracha. Because the vav of Chachameinu, our rabbis, is a problem. Who is speaking here? Who says Chachameinu? Who coined the term Chazal? Well, the answer is simple. It's post-rabbinic. Only after the rabbinic period, when a new era began, the Gaonic, as we say, they coined the idea of Chazal as a group which has a simple one understanding of everything, and you should know that no two rabbis agreed about everything, and each issue that you are going to discuss about the rabbis, you can see controversies, different opinions. I think maybe, I said quietly, maybe they agreed upon one thing only, about the existence of God. But everything else was open to discussion and debates, and we're going to read stories that were composed by the rabbis, and of course do not expect that a clear picture will emerge from reading so many stories, some written in Hebrew, some in Aramaic, some in the land of Israel, some in Babylonia, some in the first century, some in the fourth century. So we're going to read stories, and I, as you heard, taught in the Department of Hebrew Literature, so my attitude is literary, and I hope that we'll enjoy reading together stories and see what ideas can be learned from them. And the rabbinic literature, probably here somewhere, is the Mishnah, as I mentioned, and the Tosefta, and 27-11 pages of the Talmud Bavli, Babylonian Talmud, and then we have Talmud Yerushalmi, which was not composed in Yerushalayim, but out of honor to Jerusalem, it's called the Talmud Yerushalmi. In scholarly, it's called the Palestinian Targum. It's a real problem to speak about Palestinian Talmud, but that's what it's called in scholarly circles. And then we have Midrashim, and of course, Haggadah of Passover was created by the rabbis, and so are many Piyutim, poetical pieces and targumim, translations. It's a vast amount of text, and we're going to speak about stories. How many stories are there in rabbinic literature? Nobody knows. Nobody sat down to count, but if I can rely on Sefer HaAgadah, the book of Agadah, which was composed by Bialik and Ravnitsky about 110 years ago, and they collected a big number of stories, they have about 900 stories in Sefer HaGadah itself. So I assume that there are more than 1,000 stories scattered all around rabbinic literature, and I'm not sure I read all of them, but I collected those which I find very interesting, which I find relevant, which I believe that some of the people were never acquainted with, so we may meet new faces and see what stories can teach us. I'm not going into definition what is a story. There's a whole discussion in the American way, the English, the European, the German, the Russian, understanding what is a story. We know a story. When you saw a story, you see a story, you know this is a story. We're going to read stories on four different issues. And today I'd like to speak with you about stories that deal with the biography of a rabbi from conception to the afterlife, or from pre-birth to after death. Because, as is well known, every hero in any culture, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddha, whatever, the culture, historical hero, has a biography built on a very clear pattern, which is almost the same whenever you look. There are always pre-birth events. The hero does not just appear suddenly. He is here already before he's here. There can be a barren woman, an old father, and then there is prayer, there is a promise by a prophet, a promise by a priest. Angels come and tell Abraham and Sarah, or the New Testament, Gabriel came and tell Maria, whatever he told. And there are stories all over you look. In Greek culture, for example, Heracles, in Rome, for example, the story about Remus and Romulus, okay. Everywhere you look, and you can really speak about a person which is always there. And one point is there are pre-birth events, and then always sometimes there are also afterlife events. But let's start with pre-birth events. As you may know, it already goes back to ancient culture before Am Yisrael, like King Sargon in Akkadian tradition. Somebody like wanted to get rid of him. They put him in a basket. The basket was put on a river. Somehow it was found by a shepherd, whatever, and the child was saved. It always was like that. Whatever you can do to prevent the child to be born, it never worked, because providence is always there. So we know the story about Moses. We know the story in Jewish circles about Moses, but the Bible is a birth about Isaac, and again, barren woman, and prayers, and lust of hope, and angels. My friend Yair Zakovich will say, I'm citing him, if you don't have a barren woman, you cannot be a hero. But that's what's really happening here. Think about Isaac. Think about Jacob and Esau, they were born to Rebecca, Rivka. Think about Joseph and Rachel, his mother. Think about Moses. In a second, we go back to Moses. Samson in the book of Judges. Samuel, the book of Samuel. Maybe the whole Megillat Ruth is the story about the birth of Oved, the father of Yishai, the father of David. So that's the beginning of the Davidic dynasty. Even about Jeremiah, we'll see in a moment a sentence which tells us that even he was pre-birth designated for his mission. And if I look around, out of the Bible, let's look at the Christianity. I mentioned Jesus. There is a story about John the Baptist's birth, about Maria birth, about the father of the churches, like Origen and others. Everyone has a birth story, including a pre-birth event. I mentioned Rome, I mentioned Greek, and later on, it goes all the way till the Middle Ages. There is a beautiful story about the birth of Rambam, Maimonides. There is a story about the birth of the best, Baal Shem Tov, about Rashi. Because if you're a hero, cultural hero, you need some elements of pre-birth traditions. Now, what happens with the rabbis? Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasih, half of Jerusalem is names of rabbis, right? What about those rabbis? Where are their stories about their birth? They came into being, but where are the stories? On the contrary, the problem is even more complicated, because the rabbis created stories about figures which the Bible does not have stories, including Abraham and David. Abraham appears on the historical arena when he was 75 years old. What about the first 75 years of his life? The Bible says nothing. But you may know about the stories, not only about him breaking the idols of his father, but already that before he was born, the wicked king, Nimrod was his name. Nimrod in English, Nimrod in Hebrew. Nimrod saw a star swallowing four stars, and he was frightened by that, and his astrologers told him that the child is going to be born to the Hebrews, and he tried to prevent the birth of Moses, of Abraham. Of course, he failed. He could not. The rabbis created, supplied, whatever, a story about the birth of Abraham and pre-birth events. The same is true about Moses. According to the Torah, the story about the birth of Moses is the most powerful story about birth. Vayelech ish mi bet Levi, a certain man from the house of Levi, Vayikach et bat Levi, and he took as a wife a daughter of Levi, Vatar Aisha, the woman became pregnant, Vatahar ben. It happens every two seconds. I mean, men marrying a woman, pregnancy and birth. At that time, pregnancy usually followed marriage, not... Nonetheless, so if you know the stories about the birth of Moses in rabbinic literature, it's a whole 24 minutes TV show about Amram, his father, divorcing his wife because he was struck by the idea that every child will be killed. And then Miriam comes to his father and gave him peace of her mind. And Amram takes Yocheved back. And then she's an old woman. She's 130 years old, Yocheved, when she gave birth to Moses. If you didn't know that. 130, she was 130. That was the biblical text gives us. If you believe about Sarah, she was 90, you can easily go with Yocheved. I mean, that's not the problem. No, I'm serious. She was 130 years old. She came, her youth came back to her, and she gave birth to Moses with no pains, and she could hide him for 3 months because some other reason. I mean, a whole story, and the Bible has nothing about it, because the rabbis felt that great figures like Moses, like Abraham, and even like David, who has no birth story. You may remember, David appears in history as a musical phenomenon when he comes to play before Saul, or when he comes to fight against Goliath, right? But what about his birth? Rabbinic literature has birth stories about all of those these three figures, which makes the question even more interesting. The rabbis lived in a world which has birth stories. The rabbis created birth stories. The rabbis knew the Bible well. They know the Greek mythology. They know the Roman mythology. What about their birth stories? That's our question that I'd like to discuss now. And may I say that there is almost only one remnant of a birth story which we read now, and then we discuss the question, why don't we find in the vast rabbinic literature any story about a birth of a rabbi or or about pre-birth events connected to this rabbi? But let me start with text number one, and we discussed before the lecture, should I read in Hebrew, or in the original Hebrew and Aramaic, or in English? I read in the English, and we look at the Hebrew Aramaic whenever it's needed, because I'm not always happy with the translation. I'm not responsible for the translation, I took it from different sources. So that's the only story, text number one, which may be seen as a remnant to a pre-birth element regarding Rabbi Yochanan, one of the great scholars of the 3rd century, the net of Israel, Rabbi Yochanan. And the story is found in Talmud Bavli, in Tractate Yoma, which deals with Yom Kippurim, and of the question about people who must eat on Yom Kippurim, sick people, pregnant women, whatever, the whole halachic issue. And discussing about a pregnant woman who feels that she has to eat, otherwise who knows what disaster can happen to her or to the baby, comes this story. There was a woman with a child, pregnant, who had smelled a dish. She smelled, okay, way it was written here, that's probably ancient English, but anyhow, she smelled on Yom Kippur, she smelled some food, and she had to eat it. The child got crazy and ran amok, and we have to eat. What can we do? People came before Rabbi. Rabbi is Rabbi Judah the Patriarch. People came to Rabbi to ask, what should I do with this woman? He said to them, go and whisper to her, it's Yom Kippur. It's Yom Kippur. Tell her in her ear, it is the Day of Atonement. It's Yom Kippur. Just whisper to her ear. And they whispered to her, and she accepted the whispered suggestion. It's not a good translation. They whispered to her, and the child, or maybe he, got the whisper and calmed down. Very nice. So once it was told to Rabbi Yehuda the Patriarch, whereupon he cited about her, the verse about the child, not about her, before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. Or in Hebrew, Beterem etzorcha babetin yedaaticha. The verse goes on, Uveterem tetze merechem higdashticha. That's a verse that she said to Jeremiah, Prophet Jeremiah by God, which means you were prepared for this mission even before you were born, even created. Beterem etzorcha babetin. So when Rabbi Yudan heard that this fetus or baby understood it's Yom Kippur and understood that Yom Kippur you should fast, and so he can was calm down, whatever. Okay, and he called about him, and then from here came forth Rabbi Yochanan. So about Rabbi Yochanan, at least, we have a very simple story about an event. Luckily for us, it was kept here because it deals with the halachic issue of pregnant women in Yom Kippur. Otherwise, who knows, maybe the story would not even be mentioned anywhere. But this is the only story that I know. And I said before, I'm not sure I read all 1,000 stories, but I tried hard to find other birth stories which I did not find. It's the only one which brings, again, the question, how is that? I'm repeating myself just for clarity. The rabbis knew the Bible. The rabbis created birth stories to biblical figures which did not have birth stories. The rabbi knew the Greek, the Roman, the Christian traditions. What about those stories? There are three answers to this question. The first one is the rabbis did not want to compare themselves to biblical figure. Modesty. We are not like them. They are gdolim. What are we after all? In rishonim kemalachim, anachnu kebnei adam. If those are like angels, we are human beings. And if rishonim kebnei adam, if they are like humans, we are like donkeys, like chamorim. You cannot compare yourself to the great person of the Bible. That's why the rabbis, this one assumption, did not create stories about themselves. Rabbi Yochanan's story, the only exception. Some people would say the rabbis were aware of the Christian stories about birth, because most of the rabbis were in the land of Israel. Most of the Agadah which we have, please know, is made in Israel. Even if the Talmud Bavli has a lot of Agadic tradition, most of it was imported from the land of Israel. And so in the land of Israel, which was always in that time, 600 years under Roman or Christian rule, probably because he didn't want to make our rabbis similar to the great figures of the Christianity, maybe that's the reason why they did not create birth stories about themselves. But I think the better answer, and we see it now in the next text, the rabbis just did not want, they wanted to describe themselves not as figures chosen before birth and destined to greatness, but as anyone that could easily become a rabbi. All you need to achieve this high standard is to want to learn, to toil in learning Torah, to become a rabbi. So the idea of being some kind of predestination, some kind of God choosing a child before he was born for his great status, is in a way, despair. What can I do? If I was not destined to that, if God did not appear to my mother or my father and promise them that their child will be a great rabbi, can I be a great rabbi? The answer is yes. Everyone can be a great rabbi, so it doesn't have to do anything with pre-birth promises or birth surprise or birth miracles, whatever. Everyone can become a rabbi. That's why you cannot tell about them those stories, because by that you make a distinction between people who were chosen by God for this statue and others. Maybe that's the answer. I'm not sure. But instead of those stories and pre-birth stories, the rabbis created something totally different, another birth story. And now you have to look at me, because I'm going to speak about birth stories. Okay? In quotation mark, thank you, quotation mark. Stories about the birth of a rabbi, not the biological birth, but the fact in life, the point in life, how you can be as old as possible, the point of life in which you became a rabbi was born. Okay, a rabbi was born, and that's the idea of which you can easily be seen in many, many texts. And I'd like to look with you at a few of those texts to enjoy the text and really understand that the rabbis, instead of simple biological birth story, which includes pre-birth events, created a different kind of story about a rabbi to be, that was born from a simple man, even a Amma Aretz or whatever. And I think the most famous story, which we are not going to read because it's so famous, is the story about Rabbi Akiva. Everybody knows that. Even it's told to children in the kindergarten, and they know about the story about Rabbi Akiva, that he was not learning till the age of 40, and one day Rachel, the daughter of Kalba Bar Savua, saw him and sent him and promised to marry him if study Torah. And you may remember, went to study Torah, came home after 20 years, and now 24 years with thousands. This is a very famous story. It even became a very Israeli song. Rabbi Akiva is Sanu. I can sing it to you, but I feel pity for you, so I won't do it. But there is a story. Everybody knows the story. That's the story which is found in the Talmud Bavli. Talmud Bavli, according to which Rabbi Akiva was a late bloomer. He became Rabbi Akiva only when his wife, whom you call Rachel, but the Talmud never called her Rachel. The idea why she's called Rachel is another lecture. But the Rabbi Akiva's wife, named Rachel, sent him to study Torah, and then he became a great rabbi. But he came back after 24 years, and she would not be able to have children at that time already. I mean, she's too old at that time to be a mother. He acknowledged her contribution to his learning by saying the famous statement, Sheli v'shelachem shela. All, whatever I always say to students and youth is here. It's very famous but story in the Talmud Bavli. Everybody knows that. I'm not going to speak about it. I want to see the Eretz Israeli version about the beginning of Rabbi Akiva and try to understand why it's so different, why such a different story was told in the land of Israel. And for that, we are going to look at text number 3. At the beginning, then you go back to text number 2. Text number 3 is found in the Israeli text, Avot de Rabbi Natan. Text Masechet Avot, which is part of the Mishnah, was composed by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. But Rabbi Natan, who was his contemporary, composed his own Avot, and it's called Avot Shel Rabbi Natan. It's not his parents, but Masechet Avot of Rabbi Natan. And he is telling us another story. And please remember, this story which we are going to read now was composed in the land of Israel, in the land of Israel, when Rabbi Akiva lived, in the second, third century, much closer to his time, as opposed to the Talmud Bavli story, which was composed in Babylonia in the 4th or 5th century. So let's see what this story tells us, and begins with, what were the beginnings of Rabbi Akiva? That's the question. How did he become a rabbi? It is said, when he was 40 years of age, by the way, the Talmud Bavli says nothing about his age. When you speak about Rabbi Akiva that was sent to study Torah by Rachel, when he was 40, we are mixing two stories. The Babylonian story does not speak about his age. This was speak about his age. He was 40 years of age, and he had not yet studied a thing. One time, he stood by the mouth of a well. Who hollowed out this stone, he wondered. You may remember, a well was here for thousands of years, and the water was taken out in a bucket and a hevel string, right? Rope, thank you. And in many years, when the water was taken out, the water somehow spilled and created the hollows in the well. So he's interested. Who hollowed out this stone? He wondered. He was told, it is the water which falls upon it every day, continually. And it was said to him, Akiva, not Rabbi Akiva, he's still Akiva, Akiva, thou hast not, what, thou, did you not read or heard, the waters wear away the stones, tile stones, for me, the waters wear away tile stones, that's a verse from the book of Job, so water can really penetrate stone. Then Akiva, to be Rabbi Akiva, drew the inference with regard to himself, some kind of kal vachomer, and said, if what is soft, water, wears down the hard stone, all the more shall the words of the Torah, which are as hard as iron, hollow out my heart, which is flesh and blood. Forthwith he turned to the study of Torah. That's how Rabbi Akiva began to study Torah. No woman sent him for that. And by the way, he was not a shepherd of any rich Jerusalem guy. He just one day, by looking at water, and you may hear, remember, for the rabbis, Torah and water are very connected, but anyhow, and then he turned to study of Torah. And then surprise, excuse me? Chazar means istovev. The Hebrew. The Hebrew, okay, thank you. The Hebrew is chazar l'ilmod Torah. Chazar, it's not return to, but to turn around. Chazar, we speak about lechazer al haptachim, to turn around the gever. At that time, gvarim chizru achre nashim, turned around the women. Okay, nothing to do with lechazor. So, and now this, now the surprise, he went together with his son. He's a family. He's married and has a son. Please remember that the Babylonian story speaks about him going to study Torah as a condition to marrying the daughter. Only when he came back, he really married her. They were only betrothed. So in this case, no, he's married and has a son. And he went his son, and they appeared before an elementary teacher. They went to Bet Midrash, Bet Sefer. Bet Sefer, that's the age 5 to 7, kids were sent to Bet Sefer. Rabbi Akiva goes with his son, maybe his youngest son or only son, I don't know, to study Torah at the Bet Sefer. Said Rabbi Akiva to him, Master, teach me Torah. Rabbi, lamdeini Torah. And then they were so poor that Rabbi Akiva took hold of one end of the tablet and his son the other end of the tablet. At that time they had no luach, as we say, blackboard, but each children brought his own tablet, which was a piece of wood covered with wax, and he would write on the wax, and then when he finished, he would just smear the wax and write again. That was the luach. Rabbi Akiva was so poor that he could not afford two luchot, so he sat with his son, each of them hold another side of the tablet, and they started to learn. The teacher wrote an Aleph Bet for him, and you learned it. That's how you start Aleph Bet, like the famous Aleph Bet, Prepechik, whatever song Yiddish, you know that. Aleph Bet. And then you wrote down Aleph, then you wrote down Aleph Taf, the whole alphabet, and you learn alphabet. And then you learn the book of Leviticus. Leviticus, that's the first book which children at that time start to read. The Hebrew story says Torat Kohanim. Torat Kohanim, and some people think that Torat Kohanim, if you see the Hebrew, Torat Kohanim is also a name of one of the most complicated midrashim. A midrash on the book of Vayikra. He did not study that at the Beit Sefer. He studied the book of Vayikra, and the rabbis thought that studying to learn how to read, you should start with a book that is in somehow meaningless for the child at the time where there is no Beit Mikdash, and no Korbanot, and no Koranim, Tzarat, whatever. Think about the poor children who learns the book of Genesis, and already in the second week he learns about a brother murder his son, and next week God brings flood to the world, and then he speaks about father taking his son to be sacrificed on the mountain, and then about children or brothers selling their brother. I mean, it's not a book. Genesis is not a book for kids. It's not a book for kids. They come out really. I know. I have no idea. But anyhow, so the book of Vayikra, Korban Hashem, Korban Chatat, Korban Zed. That's how he learned how to read. Anyhow, so he learned how to read the book of Vayikra, and then he learned, he went on studying until he learned the whole Torah. And then I jumped, skipped this, in which he goes to the Beit Midrash and starts to learn it Mishnah with Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. And all that time, each day, Rabbi Akiva would gather a bundle of straw. Remember the Babylonian story? There he was a shepherd. Here he was a straw collector. Part he would sell to provide for his food and part for his clothing. His neighbors rose up in protest and said to him, Akiva, you are slaying us with the smoke. In Hebrew, ta oreg otanu im ha'ashan. Ta oreg otanu, ta ha'ashan. Sell the straw to us and with the money buy oil and study by the light of a lamp. I feel many needs with it, he answered them. First, I study by its light. Then I keep warm by its heat. And finally, I sleep on it. Rabbi Akiva did not leave home. He stayed at home, continued working, went to Miluim, paid his taxes, continued working, did not leave home, and went all the way to Beit Midrash for 24 years. He stays home, provides for his family, takes care of his child, working the day, studying at the night. Torah v'avodah in its best, if you can think about it. At the end of 13 years, he taught Torah to multitudes. Not 24 years, but 13 years. 13 years, BA, MA, doctorate, PhD, and postdoctorate, exactly. BA, MA, PhD, postdoctorate, 30 years. So, before he departed from the world, he owned tables of silver and gold and mounted his couch on ladders of gold. That's some kind of, he was rich as, you cannot even think about it, so rich he was. His wife used to go about in golden sandals and in a golden, was it tiara? What's it? Okay, tiara. Master, his disciples say to him, you have put us to shame, but by what you have done for her. Which means we cannot provide our wives with sandals of gold and golden whatever tiara is. We are put to shame. He said to them, say, many were the trials she endured for my sake that I might study Torah. Harbe tzar nitztara imi b'Torah. That's the story which is told in the land of Israel. It has nothing to do with the Babylonian story. He is 40 years old, very much younger. He Rachel, his wife, sends him to study Torah. He stays home with his wife. He has no children. He has a son here. So what really happened here? First of all, we can speak about what is coming to these two stories. And what is coming, I would say, is history. Rabbi Akiva was a late bloomer. A woman stood by his side. After many years, he became a great, important rabbi and even rich person, which is a problem by itself, but I'm not going to discuss the question how a rabbi can be rich. Never mind. It's too close to home. Not to Pardes, but to rabbis. Anyhow, that's maybe the historical facts that both stories are working with. But the answer was, the difference is very simple. In Babylonia, people left home to study Torah for months and even years. If you read the Talmud Bavli, there are stories about rabbis that went to study Torah for a year sometimes, or for 11 months, and came coming back home for a month, and going again for a living, whatever, because Babylonia was so huge, so big, people could not stay home and study Torah, they had to move far to yeshivot, like Pompedita, Surah, whatever. In the small land of Israel, you could stay and study Torah everywhere, so you didn't have to leave home. And on the other way, in Babylonia, they really encouraged the idea of not working and learning at the same time. In the land of Israel, you had a sandlar, shoemaker, and you had a napach, whatever napach is. Smith, thank you. I mean, people were, even the rabbis, were both working and making the living and studying Torah and conducting their communities. As opposed to Babel. So each community, the Babylonian here and the Eretz Israeli here, created its own Rabbi Akiva. Because if the ideal is to stay home and work day and learn at night, that's what Rabbi Akiva did here in Israel. If the idea is living home, of course, they have the willingness to accept or agree to that. Living home and learning Torah as well for a long time, that's our Rabbi Akiva. It's two stories. You cannot coincide them. You cannot just make you cannot harmonize them. It's either or else. One of these stories. So the question of what is the historical Rabbi Akiva is not my problem. My late teacher, Rabbi Yosef Heinemann, Zichro Livracha, who passed away 40 years and 2 days ago. I still commemorate his day of passing. 40 years and 2 days ago, would say that every morning when he says his blessing, Shelo Asani Isha, Shelo Asani, he says Shelo Asani Historion. Thanks God for not making me an historian. Because how can you make history of those texts? Excuse me, Yvonne. Okay, you're a historian. But what's the history over here? But anyhow, each community, Babylonian and Israel, created a birth story, but not biological birth, let's go put to that, not biological birth, but mental, spiritual birth. In one day, suddenly Rabbi Akiva saw water, whatever, he understood that he can also study Torah, and he went to study Torah. In Babel, he needed a woman to nudge him to go and do it, and it's two different ways of understanding the beginning of a rabbi, or how a rabbi came into being. In a way, and I don't have to do time for that, text number 4, number 5, which probably all of you know, about Hillel the Elder, about the birth of Hillel the Elder, Hillel Zaken, is a beautiful birth story, but not, again, the biological. I'd like to read it very quickly and point one point only. Hillel the Elder used to work and earn every day one tropeik, whatever it was, some kind of money, we're not sure what tropeik was. Half of which he would give to the God of the House of Learning, the other half being spent for his food and for that of his family. By the way, this is the only text I know in rabbinic literature in which he had to pay in order to enter the Bet Midrash. Bet Midrash was open to everyone, but this is the only story, and the historians really are troubled by this fact that you had to pay the God of the Bet Midrash to let you go inside and learn. Anyhow, one day, he found nothing to earn. And the guard at the House of Learning would not permit him to enter. So he climbed up and sat upon the window to hear the words of the living God from the mouth of Shemaya and Aftalion. They say that day was the eve of Shabbat in the winter solstice, right? Yeah, that's what month is that? The Shvat, we are around the time. And snow fell down upon him from heaven. When the dawn rose, Shemaya said to Aptalion, Brother Aptalion, on every day this house is light, and today it's dark. Is it perhaps a cloudy day? They looked up and saw the figure of a man in the window. Now look to this. Please look at this. They went up and found him covered by 3 cubits of snow, at 90 centimeters. Some people say it could not be an Eretz Israeli story because here we never had 90 centimeters. In Babylonia we may have, but you may remember a few years ago, on Friday night, it was the Chodesh Tevet or Shvat, there was a huge storm of snow over here, and I know, it's not a joke, I know about 2 kids at least that were born at that night called Hillel. I can give you the email. I know the kids. They are called Hillel because the mothers just knew the story. That's what will happen. Friday night, snow, the child was born Hillel. So, now let's see. They went up and found him covered by 3 cubits of snow. They removed him from the snow, from water, bathed and anointed him and placed him opposite the fire. That's exactly what he did with baby that was born. You took him out of some kind of a watery surrounding, right? You clean the child. You smear him with all kind of anointments, and then you put him near fire to warm him up. So this is a story of a birth story, but it's about a grown-up man with a family, and here Rabbi Hillel came into being. Now we have the Rabbi Hillel, and they say this man deserves that the Shabbat be profaned on his behalf. Everyone is deserves that, but for Hillel, of course, you should profane Shabbat more than once, just because such a great figure here came into being. I see this as a birth story of Hillel. I see the story about Rabbi Akiva as the best of Rabbi Akiva, and there is a famous story about Resh Lakish. If you know about Resh Lakish meeting Rabbi Yochanan in the Jordan, and then he became Resh Lakish as a scholar against of a bandit. I mean, you need have to be in a watery neighborhood in the Jordan, near a well, in the snow, and then somebody was born here, but not a baby, but a grown a person who became a rabbi. These are the best stories which rabbis have seen instead of the biological birth story which they could create but did not create. On the other hand, at the same time, text number 4, which I assume that some of you have never read before, I don't want to insult anyone, but for me it was also a surprising text. Number 4 upset me because it has another story altogether. And let's look at text number 4, a Genesis Rabbah, Midrash to the book of Genesis, in which there is a nice discussion of the question, why the Hebrew language has only 5 letters, which has 2 forms, in the middle of the word and at the end? Okay? As you know, Mem, Nun, Tzadik, Pei, Chaf. Mem, Nun, Tzadik, Pei, Chaf, Mansepach, as we call them, have 2 forms. In Arabic, as far as I remember, there are about 10 or 12 letters, which has 2 forms, in the middle, in the beginning of the word, in the middle and the end. In Hebrew, we have only 2 forms to 5 letters. Mem, Nun, Tzadik, Pei, Chaf. Why is that? Rabbi Shimon said, Mansapach, this is 5 letters, is a law revealed to Moses at Sinai. Halacha le Moshe Sinai. That's it. When Moses came down, so everything else he had with him, also he had the Mansapach. But Rabbi Jeremiah said, it was that which prophets ordained. So this is not the Halacha le Moshe Sinai, but Takana shel Nevi'im. מה שהתקינו צופים, צופים seers, people, S-E-R, right, seer? Seer. The צופים. So this is a discussion between them. Now it comes a story. It was that once on an overcast day on which the sages did not come into the assembly house, they didn't feel like studying today, it was too dark inside, I don't know, they stayed outside, there were children there. The children said, let us be as the seers. Let us play prophets. They said, what is the reason for Mansapach? What's the reason for the Mem Nun Tzadik Peichav? And the answer, from word to word, Ma'amar, Ma'amar le Ma'amar, this is the Mem, from faithful to faithful, from Ne'eman to Ne'eman, this is the Nun, from righteous to righteous, from Tzadik to Tzadik, this is the Tzadi, from mouth to mouth, Mipe le Pe, from hand to hand, mikaf lechaf, from the hand of the Holy One, blessed He, to the hand of Moses. So according to these children, this is halacha le Moshe Sinai, ma'amar ne'eman tzadik pe vekaf. The sages were so impressed, took note of the children, and great sages in Israel emerged from them. There are those that hold that they were Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Akiva. So already as a child he was part of the of the academic world and the rabbis put the iron in whatever. What do I do with this story? It contradicts everything we did so far, but probably there were different kinds of stories about the beginning of Rabbi Akiva, maybe even a pre-birth story which did not come to us, because the only one which we read about Rabbi Yochanan came just because of a halachic issue, not because of a Gadic issue. So I really am not sure I know exactly what happened from the historical point of view. Recently, a colleague, a friend of mine, Rabbi Reuven Hammer, who probably some of you know about, published a book in Hebrew, translated into Hebrew, a book in English about Rabbi Akiva, and he also is baffled by the fact what really happened here from the historical point of view. Anyhow, Rabbi Akiva is a late bloomer, and Akiva became Rabbi Akiva in some stage of his life. This is the birth story that the rabbis preferred to create. The last one, which I like to speak about birth story, will be text number 2, which we skipped so far. In this text, Rabbi Akiva himself tells us how he began to be Rabbi Akiva. It's not a story about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva tells us, this is in the Jerusalem Talmud, the J, text number 2, the J, Jerusalem Talmud, Nazir, Rabbi Akiva tells us, Amar Rabbi Akiva. This is the Hebrew. Kach haya tchilat tashmishi lifnei chachamim. Thus was the beginning of my labor of learning before the sages. That's how it began. Pam achat, one time, hayiti ma'alech bederech. I was walking along the way. Umatzati met mitzvah. The English translation is bad. I found a neglected corpse. That's not net mitzvah. Net mitzvah means a person, a killed person, or somebody who died, and no one takes care of him, and it's a mitzvah to bury him in the spot where he is found. It's the greatest mitzvah ever, to bury him there. That's the net mitzvah. That's not just a neglected corpse. So, Rabbi Akiva says, Nitapalti bo ke'arba'at mil, and then I tended to him for about 4 miles, עד שהטיב למקום הקברות, until I brought him to the graveyard, וקברתיב, and I buried him there. One Hebrew word, וקברתיב, 5 English. Think about me translating Rabbi Soloveitchik from English to Hebrew. The book shrank. The book shrank. Instead of saying, I buried him there, and I buried him there, in Hebrew, וקברתיב. So, anyhow, and they say to me, Amruli, the rabbis, excuse me, now when I came to Rabbi Eliezer and to Rabbi Yoshua, I told them what I have done. Schmitzing, see what I did? They say to me, for every step you took, you were credited as if you had shed blood. Because that's the halacha. You have to bury him exactly where he's found, met mitzvah kone mekomo, and you cannot schlep him to anywhere. Now I said, if when I intended to acquire merit, I suffered blame, אם בשעה שנתכוונתי לזכות נתחייבתי, when I do not intend to acquire merit, how much the more so, בשעה שלא נתכוונתי לזכות, על חד כמה וכמה, from that time, I have not ceased to serve sages, באותה שעה לא זזתי מלשמש חכמים, and if you know, לשמש חכמים means to study in front of them, and at the same time, to serve them, and fulfill all of the needs. That's what Rabbi Akiva tells us. So he's not a baby, he's a grown-up man, he can carry a met mitzvah, so he must be a little older than 12 years old, whatever. That's another story. So we have the story of the Nazir, we have the story of the Bereshit Rabbah, we have the Babylonian, we have the Eretz Yisrael story. What you do with that? You just have to get to know how to deal with the fact that we don't have one simple story about the beginning of Rabbi Akiva, but if we take the most famous one, the famous one is that he was born as a Rabbi Akiva in a later stage of his life, and that may be what the rabbis really want us to tell us. Everyone can become Rabbi Akiva. Do you know anything about Rabbi Akiva parents? Anyone knows anything about Rabbi Akiva parents? His father's name? Yosef. That's it. We know that Rabbi Akiva was the son of Yosef, and by that, and the information about his life. Rabbi Meir, we don't even know the name of the father. You don't have to be the son of a great rabbi. And if I look back at the 2,400 rabbis, few of them were rabbis, the son of a rabbi. Well, most of them are just one-time figure, like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Ever heard about Zakkai? Who knows about Zakkai? He was the father of Rabbi Yochanan. What about Rabbi Yochanan children? There is a sad story about their death in young of the young person. But most of, no, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who established the center of Yavne, is figure by itself. So is Rabbi Akiva, so is Rabbi Meir, so is Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish was a bandit, right, before he became Reish Lakish. You can be a descendant of Haman, I think that Rabbi Meir was somehow of Haman or whatever in Nebrak. I'm not sure, I just remember now. You don't have what you call schut avot, the marriage of father. No, everyone can become Rabbi Akiva. He needs only a wife that will push him, or himself that decides to become a Rabbi Akiva, and that's the message the stories about the best of the rabbis convey to us, according to my understanding, instead of the simple story about pre-birth events and miraculous biological. Both that the rabbis did not find fit for figures like themselves. Before we go on, any questions? Please ask something. I can take a look. Yeah. He was 40 years when he went to study Torah, yeah, and?
When he was 40, he did go to learn Torah, right? For 13 years.
When he was 40, he went to study Torah for the next 13 years.
When he was 40?
Yeah.
And isn't that the same as in the Babel?
No, Babel does not say anything about his age. Babel says nothing about his age. In Babel, they just told us that he left home for 24 years, and after 24 years, came back home with 24,000 students. His age is not mentioned there. Okay, so two different stories. I'm just depending myself to the... Okay, yes, please.
Rabbi Meir was supposedly came from Nero, with his or Nero's army commander, who was sent to Israel, who decided when he heard that he was going to be the agent of destruction, and if God would take revenge on him, he left, he became a Jew, and left in their temple.
Okay.
Is that as a pre-birth story?
No. Pre-birth story means about Rabbi Meir. We know nothing about Rabbi Meir birth, okay? The fact is his grandparents, whatever, were Romans or Nero, whatever, I don't see the part of the pre-birth events, okay? I'm debating, but I shall tell you. There was one attempt to try somehow to take both stories, the Babylonian and the Eretz Israeli story, and combine them to one story which may mean some that has some meaning, but I find the solution, which I'll tell you in a second, really horrible. Whoever wrote it, and I won't mention his name because maybe you know some of you know his name, he's not with us anymore, told us that Rabbi Akiva studied Torah with his son. In the days he worked, and at night he studied Torah and put a fire and studied near the fire. And one night, that's what this guy says, Rabbi Akiva was so tired that he fell asleep, and the fire, the house was caught on fire, and the house was totally burned. His wife, God forbid, was burned. The son was, God forbid, was burned. And Rabbi Akiva was so in despair that he went and hired himself as a shepherd to Kalba Bar Savua. And then the daughter of Rabbi Savua saw him and sent him a study Torah again. So you can do it. The price is very horrible, okay? And I think that we shouldn't go this way, but just understand that Rabbi Akiva was a great figure, and different people told different stories about him, not really looking for the historical Rabbi Akiva, but to see what messages can be brought up, the importance of studying with rabbis, text number 2, the importance of having good friends like children, text number 3, the idea of studying Torah and learning at the same time. Every one of those authors has another Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is like a chomer, which you can just play with it. Kechomer beyad ha-yotzer. So the historical Rabbi Akiva does not really interest those who told about him. But if I go back to birth stories, most of the stories tell us about how Rabbi Akiva came into being as a Rabbi Akiva. Okay. No more questions? So let's say something very quickly. Is there still time? Do you have still time yet? Yes? You're not tired? Not running home to see a chef and whatever on TV? No, you don't. No, you don't. I would like to say something about afterlife events. Next week we're going to speak about family, husbands and wife, parents, children, and we'll see next week that world has not changed very much. The same problems which we encounter today, they encountered at that time as well. But anyhow, text number six is really heart-moving, I think. It's about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, his last day. Please remember, at that time, there was no hospital. People died at home in one of the rooms. And around said the family or the students, whatever, and waited for the person just to go out, depart from this life. So when Rabbi was about to depart from this life, probably in one room in his house, he said, I require the presence of my sons. The sons were not there, but probably only his servants. When his sons entered into his presence, he instructed them, and here I really find it heart-moving, take care that you show due respect to your mother. That's what the first thing he's saying to his children. Think about it. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the patriarch, the head of the Sanhedrin, the greatest person that speaks to his children, and first he cares to the mother. Take care with your mother. And then he says, the light shall continue to burn in its usual place, the table shall be laid in its usual place, and my bed shall be spread in its usual place. In simple Hebrew, life should go on. He says, I know I'm dying, but life should go on. People should continue eating, and light should be, house should be lit, and bed should be made. That's it. And then he says, Yosef of Haifa and Shimon of Ephrat, who attended me in my lifetime, shall attend on me when I am dead. That three things which he tells his sons as a father to sons. Take care of your mother, let the house go on as nothing really happened. And the two simple men, it's not Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Shimon, Yosef from Haifa and Shimon from Ephrat, Hem shimshuni bechayai, Hem yeshamshuni bemuti. Not, as usually it really happened, that when a great person dies, suddenly everybody wants to take care of the tahara and carry the beer. It's a beer, right? And whatever, no. The people who took care of me all the time, it reminds me all kinds of moving in the newspaper sometimes, but the family writes the names of people who passed away. They sometimes added the metapelet. Right? A metapelet is very nice. It's really, I think, very human. That's what he says. The people who took care of me all my life should take care of me now in my last day. This text is in Hebrew, they can see. It's in Hebrew. Because it has at the beginning, tafresh, in the Hebrew, Tanur Rabbanan, it's a Tanaitic text. It was composed at the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, 2nd, 3rd century, in Eretz Israel, in Hebrew. But this text came to Babylonia. And the Babylonian could not believe that this what was the great things that Rabbi says on his deathbed. That's what he really cares. He says nothing about studying Torah, nothing about loving God, nothing about, no, he speaks about very daily, simple things like honor your mother, life should go on, and simple people will take care of me. In Babylonia, they could not agree that. Because now we are going, and you can see the next text was in Aramaic. You cannot see it in the English translation. That's what I put to kind of, whatever. Are you called them? You have a name for that? What's that? You have a name for that? You know what I mean. Two of those, okay? Now we are reading a Babylonian attempt to understand what Rabbi really meant. As I said before, I know what Rabbi meant. He meant what he was just said. But not for the Babylonians. Take care that you show due respect to your mother. And the Talmud is asking, is not this instruction Pentateuchal? Since it is written, honor your father and your mother? I mean, this is Aseret HaDibrot. So why would Rabbi even say something like that? Well, his kids did not know that you have to honor your parents? No. The answer is, she was a stepmother. She was not the biological mother, but the second wife which she had, and that is not included in Aseret HaDibrot, so Rabbi was not speaking about the mother, but about another. Okay, but now that. the light shall continue to burn in its usual place, etc. What is the reason? Listen to this. Rabbi used to come home again at twilight every Shabbat Eve. After his death, Rabbi Yohanasi would come back home. This is afterlife event. He would come home every Shabbat to stay with the family. That's why he needed the light and the bed and the food. So he really did not die a complete death. He would come every Shabbat. On a certain Shabbat Eve, a neighbor came to the door, speaking aloud. When his handmaid whispered, "Shh, be quiet, for Rabbi is sitting there." So the neighbor now realized that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was returning home every Friday. As soon as he heard this, he came no more. He stopped coming in order that no reflection might be cast on the earlier saint. I have no idea what the reflection is here. I'm going back to the original. Shelo leotzi la'az al tzadikim harishonim. What? Yes, the people should not say, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is coming back. What about Hillel? What about Shammai? What about Ben Zakkai? So I'm not sure the reflection is really good translation here, but whatever. So Rabbi, he decided not to come anymore in order to preserve the honor of his teachers and preachers. This is the afterlife or post-life event, the only one which I'm aware about rabbis. Besides stories about rabbis who would come in dreams to people and tell them all kinds of things, like some rabbi who, when he was dying, his student asked him to come back and tell us how is it over there, and whether dying was really painful. And he came and said, it's not painful. It was very, very simple, not painful. But even if God allows me to come back to life for another years, I won't do it. Because the fear of death is something which I cannot stand again. Not death, but the fear of death. So rough stories like that, but a real story about a person who is coming back after life is a Babylonian, I would say, invention, when they could not understand the simple idea of somebody who believes that even he is passing away, life should go on, because this is part of the way life is being done. And then, let's finish the story. And then, what about Joseph of Haifa and Shimon of Efrat, who attend me, ta-ta-ta-ta? He was understood to mean in this world. But when it was seen, however, that the bills preceded his, that died before him, because he had to go up and be ready to serve them there. It's like the Egyptians, pharaohs that were buried with their servants and horses and dogs and whatever. So their bills preceded his. All said that the conclusion must be that he was referring to the other world, and that the reason why he mentioned it was that it might not be suspected that they were guilty of some offense, and that it was only the merit of Rabbi that protected them until that moment. So if they die before him, we know that they just were destined to come up and wait for him and make Kabbalat Panim over him for there. This is pure, clear Babylonian invention in which they cannot understand what I said before, a very simple instructions of Rabbi. And then let's finish the text. I require, he say to them, the presence of the sages of Israel. And the sages of Israel entered into his presence. One, do not lament for me, he said to them, in the smaller towns. Let me explain. If you have to make hesped, do it only in big cities. Don't go to every city and make Yom Zikaron and hesped or whatever. No, but do it once in Jerusalem, once in Tel Aviv, and not in every city you have to make a hesped. Only in big towns, not everywhere. And then reassemble the college after 30 years. The yeshiva should start back after, not a year, 30 days, like Moses. Moses were wept upon 30 days. That's it. I'm not greater than Moses, he says. And do not make whole ceremonies of hesped everywhere. He was really a modest person. And then he says, my son Shimon is Chacham, my son Gamliel Nasi, and Anina ben Hama shall preside at the college. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was both the Av Beit Din, he was also the Nasi, he was the Chacham. Chacham is not an IQ test. Chacham is a function. The Chacham is responsible for the study, the system of learning. The Beit Midrash is the Chacham. The Nasi is the head of the Sanhedrin. And Rabban Chanina ben Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina, that's right. He will be the English? Yishev Barosh. Yishev Barosh Bet Adin, not the college, Bet Adin. So he divided his function into three people. Very clever, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He understood that after him would be no one that can be at the same time, both the Nasi, both the Chacham, and both the Av Bedin. So he divides it so no fights about his legacy. And then he says, I desire the presence of my younger son. Rabbi Shimon entered into his presence and he entrusted him with the orders of wisdom, how to be a Chacham, what to teach, the curriculum, whatever. I desire the presence of my elder son, he announced. When Rabban Gamliel entered, he entrusted him with the traditions and regulations of the patriarch, how to be a patriarch. And what he told him? My son, he said to him, conduct your patriarch with men of high standing. I mean, have good government with you, okay? Take people which you can trust with high standing. And don't be too nice to students. And cast, what's Baal? Among the students. The students are not your friends. You have to be a little bitter to them. To the Hebrew, Zrok Mara B'Talmidim. And I think that the Eretz Israeli stories are nicer than the one the Babylonian embellished. In a way, they added something, but really made Rabbi to a person which would come again after life, who would ask people to die before him because he needs them to serve him in the afterlife. I don't think that's what Rabbi really meant. What he really meant is what you can see in the Eretz Israeli text. But in Babel, they could not believe that that was his tzava'ah, his testament. That's why they added those additions, which I'm not very happy with, but it's again part of looking at this text. So I think that we spent a nice hour with reading this text. And next week we're dealing with family. I thank you for being so patient with me and not laughing even once at my mistakes in English, which is very nice. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.